Listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Hello, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. This is Back in the USSR on CFRU. I am Siegfried. And although I wasn't actually here last week, you know, life happened and things got rather chaotic. The past episode that I aired last week was very appropriate and provides the essential backstory, really, for what I'm going to talk about tonight. If you listened in last week or have listened in the past to the show I did last fall about the conflict on the Korean Peninsula, and the historical context of that conflict, you know, you'll definitely know the context for the current and potentially game-changing developments that have taken place in Korea from the beginning of this year. To recap, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reached out to South Korean leader Moon Jae-in during his New Year's address, calling for dialogue between the two nations and a coming together of the Korean people around the Winter Olympic Games in Seoul. Moon Jae-in reciprocated, and in spite of an altogether negative reaction from the United States, from the Trump administration, you know, the imperial power whose agenda has driven South Korean foreign policy from 1945 onwards, in spite of all that, Moon Jae-in, South Korean president worked to initiate a series of talks between North and South Korea, visits of official delegations between the two countries, a joint women's hockey team at the Olympics, and other sports-related cooperation, which saw a large North Korean delegation attend the games. And now he might have just succeeded in doing the unprecedented by getting the leaders of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the United States of America to sit down for face-to-face talks sometime this spring, sometime before May, if we're to believe the timeline that we're given now. And honestly, we don't know too many details thus far. I mean, whether that those talks, face-to-face talks between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump will happen, that remains to be seen. But this marks a dramatic shift from where we were last fall when we had, of course, Donald Trump's Fire and Fury speech it looked like the United States was about to initiate a new war on the Korean Peninsula, which might have resulted in the death of millions of people. So this is a positive development for the cause of peace in Korea. And I'd like to read a statement by the Party for Socialism and Liberation, PSL, one of the biggest communist parties in the United States today, on the potential of these Trump-DPRK negotiations, because I think it gets to the heart of the matter and puts it in proper historical context, which, needless to say, the mainstream corporate media does not. So this was the PSL's statement on the potential of the upcoming negotiations between the United States and North Korea. The announcement that Donald Trump has agreed to meet at the invitation of President Kim Jong-un and the leadership of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is an event with potentially far-reaching consequences, and its possible impact cannot be overstated. No sitting U.S. president has met directly with the North Korean government. Socialists need to be clear about what the DPRK wants. The current leadership in North Korea seeks to normalize relations with the United States. It is often stated that North Korea seeks a security guarantee from the United States. That is not accurate. The DPRK leadership, having endured nonstop hostility from the United States since the mid-1940s, is under no illusion on this score. It is important that socialists not accept the conventional language and conventional perspective of bourgeois commentators, be they liberal or conservative. The DPRK leadership knows full well, based on the history of the past 73 years, that U.S. imperialism wants to carry out regime change, overthrow the leadership of the Workers' Party of Korea, and impose neocolonial domination over the northern half of the Korean Peninsula. They know that the objectives of U.S. imperialism will not change one iota, even if they enter into negotiations, sign a peace treaty, or lift economic sanctions. In the face of the organically counter-revolutionary orientation of the U.S. empire, it is inconceivable that the U.S. political establishment and its military intelligence and surveillance institutions would ever abandon this ultimate objective of counter-revolution in Korea. This has been proven wherever imperialism has been compelled to normalize relations with any workers' state, or what is known in popular vernacular as the socialist countries. The same pattern played out with the U.S. normalization of relations between the Soviet Union earlier, as well as with the People's Republic of China in the early 1970s, and in the first steps in that direction by President Obama towards Cuba in 2015. Official normalization did not in any way, shape, or form ameliorate the desire of imperialism to overthrow those governments. The normalization of relations between the United States and various socialist governments was predicated on different needs, requirements, and realities imposed on both sides. In the case of the People's Republic of China, the Nixon administration dropped the long-standing U.S. position of excluding the PRC from the United Nations. Since the victory of the 1949 Chinese Revolution, the U.S. had used its power in the United Nations to exclude the PRC from the UN, thus allowing the rump and defeated government of Chiang Kai-shek, which illegally occupied the Chinese island of Taiwan, to be a member of the UN and one of the five permanent members of the Security Council. It may be hard to believe that the government in Taiwan actually exercised the prerogative of UN Security Council veto until Nixon changed the U.S. position, but this is a fact of history. The reason that Nixon decided to normalize relations with the People's Republic of China was to exacerbate the Sino-Soviet split and create a de facto anti-Soviet alliance between the United States and China. In effect, this is precisely what happened in the mid-1970s. Thus, we can see that U.S. imperialism had its own nefarious and counter-revolutionary goals in the normalization of relations with China. It is critically important, however, that socialists take the correct position on this question. In spite of the reactionary motives of U.S. imperialism, all genuine socialists fully supported the right of China to have normalized relations with the main imperialist government in the world. Supporting China's right to normalize relations with the United States did not mean that socialists needed to endorse China's foreign policy at the time. Normalization, regardless of the political motivations, results in less economic, military, and diplomatic pressure on a workers' state. Earlier, the United States had normalized relations for the first time with the Soviet Union after Franklin D. Roosevelt came into office in the 1930s. By 1942, the United States entered into a military alliance with the Soviet Union and Britain against fascist Germany. After the defeat of Germany and the end of World War II, U.S. imperialism resumed a counter-revolutionary offensive against the Soviet Union, inaugurating the era that became known as the Cold War. In the case of Cuba, Obama represented one sector of the imperialist establishment that concluded that the policy of naked, unadulterated hostility and aggression had failed in defeating the Cuban Revolution, and had only succeeded in isolating the United States and Latin America. The first steps towards normalization were taken by Obama, but are not completed. This was a step forward for Cuba, and the government in Havana considered it a major victory in their decades-long struggle to overcome economic and military aggression. At the same time, the Cuban leadership undoubtedly recognized that the process of normalization would present new challenges, because imperialism would present new, different, and more subtle forms to overthrow the socialist government. The effort to make a counter-revolution has not ended. Cuba strengthened its steadfastness, coupled with a supple but firm diplomatic perspective, changed the relationship of forces, and succeeded in forcing the United States to begin the process of diplomatic and economic normalization. It was a small step forward, but an important one. Obama and his faction in the ruling class did not end the blockade, even if they desired to do so, and the successor Trump administration has reversed many of the initial openings, which is another possibility that always exists in relations between imperialist and socialist countries. In examining the recent developments regarding North-South relations in Korea and the DPRK-US relations, it is important to recognize some of the important changes that have led to the possibility of the first meeting between a U.S. head of state and the leadership of the DPRK. The Obama administration's policy of strategic patience towards the DPRK was a colossal blunder from the perspective of U.S. imperialists, based on their extreme arrogance. The Obama White House assumed that the DPRK's nuclear and missile tests would not lead anywhere and were simply a form of political theater designed to create a provocation that would stimulate U.S. DPRK talks. While the United States was bogged down in the Middle East, the DPRK used the 8 years of the Obama administration to develop a significant nuclear and long-range and intermediate missile capability. The ultimate success of the DPRK in acquiring new advanced weapons technology systems, both in the area of nuclear weapons and long-range missile technology, has shifted the relationship of forces. The DPRK obviously does not want to initiate a war with the United States, but it has developed a credible deterrent capability, including a capacity to strike long-range targets with nuclear weapons in the event of a war. The Moon Jae-in government in South Korea has from the beginning sought to initiate a thaw in North-South relations. His government and senior staff are part of a sector within the South Korean political establishment that dates back to the ascension of Kim Dae-jung in the late 1990s. This is the liberal wing of the South Korean political establishment, and many of its key cadre and leaders date their own political genealogy back to the radical student movement in the 1970s and 80s, which was repressed by the South Korean military dictatorship with the backing of the United States. The Moon administration and South Korean government has limited sovereignty because of the preponderant position of U.S. imperialism in the country. This includes U.S. military forces, who are still technically the operational leadership of the South Korean military in the event of a military crisis. President Moon has been determined to move the peace process forward and has done just that, while at the same time making every effort not to offend Donald Trump or the United States. The leading force in this process from within the U.S. establishment appears to be Donald Trump himself, as odd as that may seem. Trump has made the most bellicose statements against North Korea, has imposed severe sanctions to economically punish the entire Korean people, and his administration treated the symbolic steps towards peace at the Olympics with contempt. But the Trump White House is beleaguered, under extreme domestic political pressures, targeted by a profound intestine battle going on within the political forces in the U.S. ruling class, and a criminal investigation which could lead to additional indictments and possible impeachment. Thus, for personal and political reasons, Trump can envision himself as the leader who could effect a historic change in a primary global political arrangement. Richard Nixon, the right-wing war criminal and anti-communist, became the political leader within the establishment who opened the door to normal relations with Red China, as it was known. Nixon cemented for himself the reputation as a grandmaster in geostrategic politics. Donald Trump, a mid-level real estate developer and reality TV personality whose star was in eclipse before he even ran for office, can envision himself as a celebrated and grand deal maker to conclude a war that began 68 years ago and has never ended. It is clear from the coverage in the capitalist mainstream media, reflecting the different factions and trends within the U.S. ruling class, that Trump is, at least for the moment, bucking the tide of skepticism and hostility. There are already big attacks against him for having dared to suggest that the United States could open direct negotiations with the DPRK under current circumstances in which the DPRK has strengthened its position militarily. Under pressure from ruling class opposition, Trump is now hedging and putting preconditions on the meeting with the DPRK, leaving open the possibility that the meeting will not actually happen. The Party for Socialism and Liberation and other socialists firmly support the right of the DPRK to have normal relations with the U.S. government and any government in the world. The economic sanctions imposed on the DPRK are designed to cause famine and economic destabilization and regime change. The diversion of a large part of its national budget for military and defense purposes is also a drag on socialist economic construction and makes it harder to provide the population with food, fuel, and medicines, as well as consumer goods that are necessary and desired. The PSL's position towards the DPRK and other socialist governments is one of political defense against the forces of imperialism and domestic counter-revolution. We are politically independent. We establish our own assessment, analysis, and political orientation. The anchor of our political understanding and strategy is militant and uncompromising opposition to imperialism in its pursuit of regime change, strategies against socialists, and also bourgeois nationalist governments, which were created as a part of the anti-colonial revolutionary wave of the post-World War II era. We do this while retaining absolute political independence in order to assess unfolding events in a way that provides clear political understanding and orientation for the working class movement inside the United States. So that's the Party for Socialism and Liberation statement about the possibility of talks between the U.S. government and North Korea. So what I want to play right now is I want to play a talk that was given on the Real News Network recently, a series of interviews that were done discussing what this means, the implications of these upcoming talks, which look set to happen between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, and the prospects for peace on the Korean Peninsula. So I'm going to play that right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Mate. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un have agreed to historic face-to-face talks. South Korea's national security advisor made the announcement from the White House.
Kim pledged that North Korea will refrain from any further nuclear or missile tests. He understands that the routine joint military exercises between the Republic of Korea and the United States must continue. And he expressed his eagerness to meet President Trump as soon as possible.
The meeting is set to be held sometime before May. If it goes through, it would be the first ever between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. It's a dramatic turn after months of bellicose rhetoric between the two sides that left many fearing nuclear war. I'm joined by two guests. Tim Shorrock is an independent journalist who covers U.S.-Korea relations for The Nation and the Korea Center for Investigative Reporting. And Christine Ahn is a founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Welcome to you both. Christine, I'll start with you. Your reaction to this historic news?
It's nothing short of a miracle. I mean, it really is extraordinary. And I think the tremendous outcome of very hard and nimble diplomatic work by Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president. We often hear in the media now that this is the result of maximum pressure, the Trump administration's policy of more economic strangulation of North Korea, forcing other countries to cut off diplomatic ties with Pyongyang, and of course the provocative military posturing, that this is what brought North Korea to dialogue. And I think that's a very terrible distortion of what took place. And I think that that is, if that is the true belief, that things are not going to go well in terms of talks, because what has changed, I mean, whether you call it maximum pressure or under the Obama administration, strategic patience, that policy of putting an encircling North Korea and putting maximum pressure has not yielded North Korea to dialogue. And so what has is this kind of masterful diplomacy by Moon Jae-in, where he, you know, truly showed respect to the North Korean leadership when they came for the Pyeongchang Olympics, and you know, has really listened and heard North Korea's concerns about their security concerns. And so I believe that that's going to be really important for the talks between Kim and Trump to be successful.
Tim Shorrock, if you could pick up on that, you interviewed Moon Jae-in when he was running for the South Korean presidency. Since he's taken office, what has he done to get us to this moment?
Well, when I interviewed him, this was about 10 months ago, right before he took the presidency, 2 days before he was elected. He told me in response to critiques of his approach to North Korea from here in Washington, you know, people were saying in Washington, well, he's going to divide the U.S. from South Korea because he's going to be wanting engagement, and that's not what Trump wants, and that's not what the U.S. wants. And his answer to me was, you know, if I try to develop engagement and reduce the tension between North and South Korea, and then between North Korea and the U.S., that'll be good for the United States, and that should be good for the Trump and be welcomed by Trump. And that was the gamble he took, and he won that gamble. And since he took president, one of the first things he did was to suggest, you know, cross-border talks with North Korea on military issues and family divisions. And the North Korean government basically ignored him while they progressed on their nuclear and missile tests. But their idea, I guess, was to, you know, complete, as they called it later, their state nuclear force by sometime last year, which they did by testing all these missiles and also testing one nuclear device. And so by the time January 1 rolled along, they felt that they had built enough deterrence to defend themselves against the United States. And as we all know, January 1, Kim Jong-un made this overture to South Korea, and Moon Jae-in immediately answered by saying yes, he would like to engage, and the North Koreans offered to send a high-level delegation to the Pyeongchang Olympics, which they did. And during those Olympics, there was a deep negotiation between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un's sister, who was there, and a very high-ranking former foreign minister of North Korea, who was also in South Korea. And you know, Kim Jong-un's sister invited Moon to to a visit to North Korea for a summit meeting. And Moon Jae-in responded by saying, I would like to have a summit meeting, but I'm not going to do it until the conditions are right. And he wanted North Korea to make some kind of concessions on its nuclear tests and its missile tests, and to answer some of the respond to some of the security concerns of the United States before he agreed. And that's what happened when he sent his national security advisors to North Korea last week. And they met for a couple of days with Kim Jong-un and his top leaders. And they came back with this deal, which is basically along the lines of the kind of freeze for freeze that was discussed a lot last year, where North Korea would freeze its missile tests and its nuclear tests in exchange for a moratorium or a scaling down of U.S. South Korean military exercises. And what he agreed to was, he agreed that the exercises could continue if they're scaled down, and that's what has basically happened. So the big surprise here was that, you know, the South Korean, you know, Moon Jae-in sent a delegation to the White House to meet with Trump and his people, and they brought this invitation from Kim Jong-un to meet with Trump, and Trump accepted. So I think, you know, huge credit, you know, to Moon Jae-in. Without his hard work and diplomacy, this would not have happened.
Christina, I think this raises a good point, which is that there's been criticism coming from many circles towards Trump that he didn't extract any concessions from North Korea before agreeing to the summit. But, you know, as Tim just said, North Korea, as a part of this deal to meet with Trump, and as even the South Korean envoy said, North Korea has accepted continued U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and more importantly, I think, has committed itself to stop testing until the summit.
I think that's absolutely right, and I'm surprised that they didn't request some kind of reciprocation from the U.S., because it has been a longstanding, you know, I don't want to say condition, but just some concern from their part, obviously, about the provocative military exercises that include decapitation strikes and other rehearsal for the invasion. But I think that shows very much the seriousness by which North Korea is approaching these talks. And, you know, clearly the Trump administration, I mean, that was obviously a huge overture from the North Korean side. But the mere fact that the Trump administration has agreed to engage in dialogue, there must be something else that we have not yet seen, you know, that has yet to emerge. And, you know, I just think that it's just incredible, whether it's from the disarmament community or, you know, liberal think tanks, you know, how dare we allow this kind of dialogue to take place without, you know, squeezing more out of North Korea. And I just think that that does not look at all at the bigger picture of what has been at place, which is an unresolved Korean conflict, which is a historic division between North and South Korea by external powers. And, you know, it takes somebody like Moon Jae-in that understands deeply. His mother is from North Korea. There are millions of separated families. You know, there's, you know, the most militarized border that maintains 1.2 million landmines in the DMZ. And, you know, there are bigger issues facing the Korean Peninsula. And I think that Moon Jae-in has a holistic view of that. And I think it's just time for the U.S. media and, you know, the so-called experts on Korea to take stock of all the issues. And, you know, when we talk about denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, I mean, what about the issues that North Korea is bringing forth, which is who introduced nuclear weapons, first of all, onto the Korean Peninsula? You know, South Korea and the nuclear umbrella by the U.S., other, you know, the use of strategic bombers, nuclear bombers in these military exercises. I mean, you know, there's just a singular focus and myopic view of, you know, 20 North Korean nuclear weapons compared to the 15,000 in the world, which is largely possessed by the United States. So I just think that, you know, let's widen the frame here. And it's an opportunity, you know, to push for a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. But it has to first begin with a conversation about securing the guarantee of North Korea. We know already from the Korean War that they were devastated. 80% of North Korea was bombed to bits. And, you know, there are reasons, not that I am a proponent of nuclear weapons, but we can certainly understand of all the countries in the world that has sought the pursuit of nuclear weapons for a deterrent, it is North Korea.
Right. And as we know from reporting on North Korean strategic thinking, the example of Libya and Iraq, where in the case of Gaddafi, he gave up his nuclear weapons program and then got overthrown and killed. And in the case of Iraq, it didn't have nuclear weapons. It got overthrown and invaded. So that certainly informed Kim Jong-un's thinking. Tim Shorrock, in terms of what's at stake here historically, in what Christina's talking about, we often forget, I'm wondering if you could explain this a little bit, how, in fact, the Korean War has never officially ended.
No, it ended with an armistice, which is just merely, you know, putting the guns down, and in the U.S. case, putting its bombers down. So there was supposed to be a peace agreement, but that never came forth. And you know, instead, you know, the division just became, you know, frozen, and bitterness, you know, grew between North and South Korea after the Korean War. And so, you know, this crisis actually, you know, began, I mean, like Christine said, it was the United States that introduced nuclear weapons. It threatened North Korea with nuclear weapons during the Korean War. A couple times actually flew lone B-29s over Pyongyang. Lone B-29s that the same kind that flew over Hiroshima and Nagasaki to kind of scare the hell out of them. And then, of course, they had what they call tactical nuclear weapons there for years. You know, some of these nuclear weapons the U.S. deployed in South Korea could be carried on soldiers' backs. That could be shot in the battlefield. And, you know, George H.W. Bush in 1991 withdrew those nuclear weapons, you know, from South Korea and a lot of other countries where the U.S. had them deployed. But, of course, the U.S. 7th Fleet, and you know, in the U.S. air bases around Korea, the Korean Peninsula, including in Guam, the U.S. has these strategic bombers that do of course carry nuclear weapons. And so it's North Korea is still, you know, threatened by U.S. nuclear forces. And so that's, you know, one of the primary reasons the North Koreans, you know, kept on building, you know, decided to build a nuclear capacity. And they began this in the you know, late 1980s. And of course it came to a head in the early 1990s, which was when, you know, Bill Clinton, under the Clinton administration, you know, crafted this agreement with North Korea that froze their nuclear program prior to them having a nuclear bomb, that froze their program for about 12 years. Until the agreement was basically blown apart by the Bush administration in 2002 and 2003. You know, so, you know, there is a track record of talks and negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea, and a lot of lessons that can be learned from that period from the late 90s to around 2000.
And we're going to talk more about that in part two of this discussion, where we're also going to get into something Christine mentioned, which is the liberal reaction to this news of a summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Let me ask Christine on, though, as we wrap part one, if the goal here of the U.S. is to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, is that possible? Is that a realistic goal with this summit?
Well, it's as Moon Jae-in says, you know, that should be the ultimate end goal of a peace process. But as we have known, that North Korea's position has been that they would be willing to give up their nuclear weapons as long as there was a security guarantee of, like, whether in the form of a peace treaty or a non-aggression pact from the United States, you know, and the U.S., you know, putting aside its hostility, whether it's in the form of the military exercises or, you know, the brutal sanctions that really hamper the growth of its economy. So, you know, that's my concern, is that if we take this this certain framework that is being put forward by the media, that the maximum pressure is what worked to force North Korea to dialogue versus a much more diplomatic, you know, fancy footwork by Moon Jae-in that really took into account North Korea's security concerns and a genuine peace overtures, whether it's in the form of being respectful and listening closely, or, you know, I mean, I guess I would hand it to the Trump administration for bringing the two Koreas together, because I guess in the one sense that when you threaten to totally destroy a country, that would then lead to a counter retaliation on South Korea, because there's 80 U.S. bases and 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, that of course, and that I guess would force the two Koreas to get together to talk. But my concern with that framework is that that doesn't look at then the other side of the equation, which is North Korea's genuine security concerns. And if you are going to try to reach a successful denuclearization deal, you must address those security concerns.
All right, we'll leave it there for part one. Tim Shorrock and Christine Ahn, join us in part two.
U.S. forces give the nod. It's a setback for your country. Bombs and trenches all in rows. Bombs and threats still ask for more.
Me.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And once again, of course, I am Siegfried. And that, of course, was Midnight Oil with their song US Forces. Now, I think Christianon and Tim Scheck, these people who were getting interviewed on the Real News there in that that clip, which I aired before before the music there, they really don't give enough credit to the North Korean leadership, Kim Jong-un. I mean, they talk all about like Moon Jae-in and the role he played, a very significant role he played, needless to say, like around reciprocating. But effectively, the main thing that he did is he reciprocated the initial peace overtures that North Korea was making around right at the beginning of the year, like in the New Year's address that the North Korean leader gave, Kim Jong-un gave. He was reaching out to South Korea saying, like, you know, we want to talk to South Korea. We want to initiate dialogue with the South Korean government. We want a delegation to go to the Olympic Games for there to be, peaceful negotiations surrounding the Olympic Games, peaceful, like, through sport, building peaceful relations, you know, forming like a joint women's hockey team, engaging like diplomatic exchanges, all this sort of thing. And they did that, you know, like basically Moon Jae-in, he responded positively to that and managed to get the regular and incredibly threatening, at least in North Korea's point of view, the incredibly threatening war games and war and maneuvers which the U.S. and the South Korean militaries engage in every year, simulating an invasion of North Korea and using like nuclear-capable bombers and things like this, and practicing decapitation strikes on the North Korean leadership and that kind of thing. They suspended that during the Olympic Games, just as North Korea suspended its any sort of missile testing, any of that sort of thing. And now there's talk of carrying that forward. Now, of course, like the both Korean governments want to carry that forward, that truce forward, that mutual de-escalation forward. And it really is a mutual thing. And certainly the North Korean leadership, just as much as Moon Jae-in in South Korea, is responsible for that. It really and initiates this. It certainly isn't the United States that initiated this. The United States was the main stumbling block, the main obstacle to these peaceful relations between North and South Korea. And that needs to be understood. And I think what puts that in perspective is the subject of the next clip I'm about to play, which deals with the situation where we were about a month or so ago when we, of course, had the North Korean missile scare, false nuclear missile scare in Hawaii, which caused a panic. And at the same time, we also had Trump dramatically escalating the situation with a new American nuclear arms doctrine, which dramatically lessened the threat threshold that it took for a, where the United States would consider using nuclear weapons, you know, and dramatically escalated the tension. So just to put in perspective, like where we stand now, how things have de-escalated since then, I think it's important to keep this in mind. This is another interview that was done on the Real News Network with Aaron Maté last month concerning how Trump escalated the situation in the Korean Peninsula before the current thaw and the prospect for new peace talks. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. With his tweets and statements about bombing North Korea, President Trump has set off global panic over nuclear war. Well, now his brand new nuclear strategy raises the alarm even more. A draft of Trump's forthcoming nuclear posture review calls for upgrading the nuclear arsenal to confront Russia and China. And for the first time, it would permit the use of nuclear weapons even in response to a non-military attack, like the cyber hacking of U.S. infrastructure. Rick Wayman is Director of Programs and Operations at the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. Rick, welcome. I want to start with a quote from this forthcoming nuclear posture review. Hasn't been put out yet, but there has been a draft leak. Okay, and this is what it says. The U.S. would only consider the use of nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances to defend the vital interests of the U.S., its allies, and partners. Extreme circumstances could include significant non-nuclear strategic attacks. Significant non-nuclear strategic attacks include, but are not limited to, attacks on the U.S., allied or partner, civilian population, or infrastructure. So, Rick, explain that for us. How unprecedented is this for the U.S. to say that non-nuclear attacks, even non-military attacks, could be grounds for the U.S. use of nuclear weapons?
Well, thanks for having me, Aaron. This is a really disturbing development in U.S. nuclear posture. Over the decades, our posture has been very aggressive, but it hasn't quite gone this far in defining what exactly we would consider as deserving of first use of nuclear weapons. And the language in the Obama Nuclear Posture Review back in 2010 talked about defending the vital interests of the United States and allies, but it didn't go into that level of detail as to what those vital interests might be. Most disturbingly, talking about non-nuclear attacks deserving a nuclear first use by us. So it's definitely many steps in the wrong direction that we're taking here with this draft Trump nuclear posture review. Not the direction that we need to be going. There are enough dangers that we're dealing with in everyday life without being this explicit and threatening others in such a real way.
Right, Rick. So you mentioned Obama's previous nuclear strategy, and this is where it's important to not pin everything on Trump here. It's not just Trump who is advancing this policy. Trump is calling for continuing the Obama policy of spending more than $1 trillion to, quote, upgrade the nuclear arsenal. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. The current price tag on that is around $1.25 trillion over the next 30 years. With the Trump nuclear posture review, that price tag is likely to rise because there are some new proposals and possible new programs in there. That's about $80,000 a minute on nuclear weapons and their delivery systems for 30 years. That's a really mind-boggling figure. This plan was begun under Obama. Part of it was a compromise with Senate Republicans to get the New START Treaty ratified back in 2009-2010. The Obama plan goes far beyond what they were talking about during the New START negotiations. We're talking about replacing the warheads and all of the components. We're talking about rebuilding the production infrastructure in New Mexico, California, Tennessee, and other parts of the country. We're talking about new submarines, new airplanes, new land-based missiles to deliver nuclear weapons. And we're also talking about a new command and control system. All of these things are hugely expensive. Their price tag right now is $1.25 trillion. The military and their contractors are not known for being on budget. So this is going to cost us a lot more. And, the last thing I want to say about that is the price tag is one thing. There are a lot of human needs. We all know people in this country and around the world need a lot of things, infrastructure, healthcare, food, et cetera. But cost is only one issue. The real issue here is that these weapons threaten all of us. And that's really what it comes down to and really why it's so unacceptable.
And can you talk about, because of the way the nuclear arsenal is developed and maintained, the sort of very, very short time constraints it puts on the president and the military in terms of how much time it gives them to decide on whether or not to use weapons? It's something like down to 6 minutes or so now, if they feel as if they need to launch a strike to counter, say, a missile from Russia?
Yeah, so this has gotten a lot of renewed attention lately, both because of the false alarm text message that went out in Hawaii over last weekend, as well as there's a lot of concern about whether our current president is capable of making rational decisions around the use of nuclear weapons. But yeah, this is the case right now. Our posture, our strategy is to launch on warning. So if our radars and our early warning systems detect an incoming missile or missiles from Russia, from China, from really any nuclear armed adversary, our posture is to launch particularly our land-based missiles prior to the incoming weapons detonating on our soil. So the president only these weapons, they take anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes from launch to detonation. So the president would have a very short amount of time, 6 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes in a best case scenario, really, to make a decision about whether to launch our nuclear warheads on this warning, which could be real. It could be a false warning. The key is, once the decision is made for us to launch our land-based missiles, you can't call them back. So if you launch them and then you realize that it was a false alarm, it's too late. Those missiles are going to their targets and they're going to detonate. So there's a real danger here, not only of nuclear weapons being used on purpose, but also on accident because of a false alarm, because of a technical glitch or a human error.
So, Rick, finally, you were very involved in the process that led to the passage in July at the UN of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. The ratification process is underway. The U.S. is opposed to it. Russia has just confirmed it will not be joining. But meanwhile, it is proceeding in the background with dozens of countries signing on. Can you talk about where it is at today and what impact it could have on the efforts to ultimately reduce and hopefully ban nuclear weapons?
Well, like you said, the ratification process is underway. Over 50 countries have already signed on, and many of them are in the process of ratifying it within their own parliamentary structure. So we expect, as 2018 goes on, more and more countries are going to be lodging their official ratification at the United Nations. We need 50 countries to ratify this treaty in order for it to officially enter into force. But it is already having an effect. And one really important effect, in my opinion, is that there are a couple of very large pension funds, one in Norway, one in the Netherlands, that very recently, because of the ban treaty and how it explicitly makes nuclear weapons illegal, these pension funds have decided to divest from companies that produce nuclear weapons. So these are pension funds that control hundreds of billions of dollars, and they're pulling out. They recognize that the international community has said a resounding no to nuclear weapons, and they don't want to be involved in funding the further production. So it's a really positive step. Just a few months ago, I believe it was September 2017, Amalgamated Bank, which is based here in the U.S., was the first U.S. bank to declare a policy of divesting from nuclear weapon producers. So there is some momentum in the financial sector around this. And I think that's one really important way that we can all have an effect. Many of us have a bank account or perhaps some investments somewhere. I think it's really important to find out where those companies are investing their money, if they're investing in nuclear weapons producers, and putting pressure on them to get out of it. It's something that we all can do. And when the money comes out of it, it suddenly becomes not such an attractive thing for companies to be involved in. So a great resource for that is a website called Don't Bank on the Bomb. There they have listed all of the financial institutions that are involved in investing in nuclear weapons production. So I encourage all your viewers to check that out and put some pressure on their banks.
We'll leave it there. Rick Wayman of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Aaron.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
To a cancer, realize the reason, treason, the answer. Deprecate play in the status game, or cascade into the depth of the slain. Dark are the days.
Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days,
dark are the days. Dark days while I was lurking, tasks can't be shirking. Jerking back and forth. South to north and east to west, bless ocean and seas, marksman,
360 degrees,
dialectic, abstract, act and negate, I know you never found me, knock at heaven's gate, religion and illusion, opium of the people, and just saw busters, to wit equal, and so to the news, of a day dog, a child was abused, man stabbed in the park, the union's rejected, 9%, Lady Di's dress was heaven sent. We got mass confusion, therefore mass delusion, media, a bourgeois institution.
Survive. No work at 9 to 5 with no job pride. Wages impractical, the boss, Mr. Mister. Turn like a slave for you ever since dismissed ya. Doctor, doctor, you clean up and slop ya. Suck up to the bourgeois and then they sack ya. Power struggles run amok and we bear the brunt. But marksman punt to stun bourgeois grunts. We're past leading present, the future consequential. Reform fundamental, we've all potential. West implanted, East now supplanted. Sorry you're the selfish ones that ranted. But the marks bar lit the flame in the heart. And now the West ways are dark. Dark are the days.
Dark are the days, dark are the days.
Darkness. Watch me as a spark plugs bust and disperse. Thrust cuss is the hardness. Hark to the poet, the one that edutains. Even if I blow it, marksman remains. Cock a doodle doo, son, all this has begun. Run a little lyrical, some concoction. Little put a break on the man. He's got a system, but his system's out of hand. Overproduction of food is a crime. When there's mass starvation, a nation is dying. How can you justify stand up and decry the communist? When you stand for all this, persist in your madness and be damned. As the tables turn to a clenched hand.